Hi, I'm Terry Meekin. Welcome to Roving Report. Huntington's disease is an inherited condition that damages certain nerve cells in the brain, and it gets progressively worse over time. It cannot be cured or reversed. Only a charity, the Huntington's Disease Association, provides support workers for people and family living with this disease. I asked Carol Dutton to tell us more about the disease and how she often has to act as a go-between between the state and the families suffering from Huntington's.
Huntington's disease is a rare inherited neurodegenerative disease of the central nervous system. It affects both males and females. It normally starts between the ages of 30 to 50 years old. What I call a hidden condition, and generally families tend to look after each other. So some families have never seen any health professionals until we get referrals.
So are you saying that some people don't even know they got it, or they just don't, they think it's something else?
Both. I mean, some people are aware that they're probably showing signs of the condition, but actually don't want to go any further. They don't want to be told, you know, they've got the disease, because it's a life-limiting condition. So an adult onset is between 15 and 20 years, though we know that people are actually living longer than they used to.
So what are the symptoms?
What we tend to find in the early stages of the disease is general short-term memory, poor coordination, fidgety, a bit temperamental, they've got poor temper control.
People must know that others in the family have died from it.
Not always. But we're finding, interestingly, the last two or three years, we're getting a lot more what we call older onset Huntington. So people over the age of 60, 65. And often what we found is that during the World Wars, you know, World War II, the mother or the father went off to war and got killed. And they were quite young. So they didn't develop the disease.
Right. Interesting.
You know, and then this next generation that coming through are often being misdiagnosed having Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, the classic. If they don't know what it is and you're old and you've got involuntary movements, they call it senile chorea.
If a doctor doesn't know what he's dealing with, mm-hmm. how do you diagnose it? Is it done genetically? Can you actually take a blood sample and see that there's a missing piece of information?
Mm-hmm. There's two ways. Often if the GP's got concerns about somebody's presentation, there's an involuntary movement, they can't quite work out what it is. And they're often referred to neurology. So it's quite interesting. Some GPs have really good knowledge about Huntington's because often they've seen two, three generations of families coming through their doors. I'm often dealing with three or four generations of families. So I'm dealing with the grandparent, I'm dealing with the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. If the GP has no idea what they're dealing with, they should be referred to neurology, and then it's picking up the neurologist that has experience with what they call a movement disorder.
So how are we fixed in this area for neurologists who know what they're doing?
Right. We have a very good neurologist that I work alongside called Dr. Silver.
Just the one?
Yeah.
So if he goes off sick?
Yeah. Or on holiday?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how many people in a county have got it?
160-something.
Okay.
And there's about 400-plus at risk of inheriting the disease.
So we've got a rare disease, genetically hereditary. Only one specialist knows how to handle it, and many doctors can't even pick it up. When it has been picked up, what's the progression of the disease?
So often it's low mood, depression. We have quite a high suicide rate with this condition as well, so we have to sort of manage the mood really, really well. So that's why the counselling's so important with the genetics. And then we sort of pick them up as well. That's if they want our involvement.
But is that depression chemical or is it emotional?
Both.
It's like kind of pinned in a moving target, this, isn't it?
It is. The issue with Huntington's is looking at the best ways to treat them. And we found the majority of our people that we see, the families that we see, need some form of help with their low mood and their depression, because, you know, you've got to think, well, is the depression caused by the condition or is it because of life in general? Because everybody gets suffers with depression. And also we have problems with sleeplessness. We have issues around weight loss, because if they've got constant moving, they're burning off a lot more calories. So we have to go quite a wide range of professionals involved right from the very beginning. We have three types of HD. So we've got juvenile Huntington's, that's people up to the age of 20 diagnosed with Huntington's, and their lifespan is certainly much shorter. The disease accelerates at a much faster rate. So then you need a huge range of professionals, paediatrics. You need, you know, they need the schools, the colleges involvement as well, making sure that they get the right level of care, and then their education as well. And then we've got the adult onset, which is, I said, 30 to 50. And then we've got older onset. So
whatever age you get it at, your lifespan is still the same because it's the same disease. It just comes at different times of your life.
Yeah, the longer you develop Huntington's, the lifespan is shorter.
Are you employed by the NHS?
No. But most of my funding, I'm not health or social care funded, is done by my own charities and trusts around.
So you don't get anything from the NHS at all for support in the. So you're basically doing a job of a social worker, a nurse, a carer, and an advisor, all on the chip, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We do have a couple of regional advisors who are funded by the lottery, which is quite good. But that was a huge amount of work.
If your organisation doesn't exist, who's going to take up the responsibility?
Yeah, that's always the scary part, really, because the families trust us greatly, you know. And we're with them, but we never close cases. We are with them, you know, from beginning to end.
But are you saying that the NHS does not recognise Huntington's disease as something which needs to be managed themselves if the charity didn't exist?
Well, I don't know what would happen to our patients if we weren't around. No, it would be chaotic. That's the worry, really, because I always worry about, you know, if I retired, who would look after them? That's always the worry. I wouldn't retire.
Are you the only person in the area looking after them, aren't you?
I cover three counties. We're quite a small charity. We cover England and Wales. Scotland have their own association.
I presume you're not trained as a nurse?
No.
So if you're a person working for a charity because you feel that people need assistance in there, you haven't actually got any legal right to say, look, you need this course of treatment, that course of treatment. All you're doing basically is helping support for these people. Is that right?
Well, I think the professionals find our input invaluable. And we are seen as professionals. And we are seen as specialists.
On the cheap.
Well,
because they're not paying, because they're not picking up the tab.
They recognise our role, about our input, you know, and we can pick up things in the community. So when we see people at home, often they turn up at the clinic and they say, I'm fine, there's no issues. Whereas I'll come in and say, well, actually, we do have a few problems, you know, and could we consider some treatment?
What made you as a person get into this area of work?
I worked in social care and I had a gentleman in our local town who was affected with the condition. I had no idea where it was. My father had Parkinson's at 46. So we'd grown up with a dad with a neuro condition. He just touched a chord in me when I saw the squalor he was living in and how poorly he was. And nobody cared, you know. There was just no support out there for him. He hadn't been diagnosed. His one worry was his dad had Huntington's disease. And his dad was extremely violent.
But and it must be very difficult for partners as well, because partners aren't changing their characteristics.
Yeah.
But their other partners can turn into something completely different.
Yeah, I mean, we have to make sure that the carers or the partners or the husbands and wives are supported. It's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week job, you know, for a lot of them.
And if they can't cope, what do you do? Do you take the person with the HD out of the environment and put them somewhere else?
Well, what we do, we get the social care support, you know, the adult community care team in to do an assessment to see what support they can offer, do a carer's assessment on that person, try and put in a bit of support, maybe consider some respite or daycare support, or maybe a direct payment, you know, where they can employ somebody, or they can come in and take the person out for the day. Because remember, mine are young. You know, the majority of mine are quite young.
When you say young, what do you call young?
The majority of them are 40s and 50s. You know, a lot of them have been working, been driving, had good careers. But this disease chips away at you, you know, and it's slowly, slowly.
But the point about it is, from what you're saying, if you have the disease, it's a slow death sentence. Because eventually, it kills people.
Yeah, well,
I mean, everybody dies in the end, but I mean, they know that this is going to take them in that direction, so I suppose that's hard to handle.
It is, for a lot of the families, because they're aware of what the future holds for them, because they've seen their parent or sibling affected with the condition. So it's trying to get as much support for them throughout the course of the condition, as long as you can. So you can look at psychology, psychiatry, you know, general counselling, and actually living each day as it comes, you know?
Do you ever get people walk away from it? So I can't do this anymore.
Yeah. And then we have to, a lot of mine live on their own, Some people have walked out and said, I can't cope anymore. That's because it's come to crisis. Mm-hmm. If we'd have got in before, we'd have known it was going to come to crisis. Maybe we could have averted that crisis. Actually, a lot of them still keep in touch with them. You know, they can't live together, but they can't live apart from one another. And you might find that actually
keep
that person's better.
Eye.
Yeah, we might be able to put in the care package in the home, and then that person's still involved in their sort of general life. Because often, you know, these people have got families, you know, their own children. We need to make sure that the children are as well supported as well. So it's not just the person with Huntington's we're looking after, it's the carer.
How many workers nationally in the charity?
We have about 22, 23 specialist advisors like me. We have a youth worker. He's done some marvellous work with our youngsters. Because often, you know, we're too busy to be dealing with the children as well. Mm. That's what we were dealing with before I'm on board.
What do you think would improve the work that you do?
For people to really learn about the disease, maybe set up a proper support network for them, because it's so chaotic out there. You're trying to deal with one, say, with health, and then you're dealing with mental health, and you're dealing with social care, and you just seem to be repeating yourself the whole time.
So you really got to pull in a lot of the other professionals, social workers, health workers, doctors. Every carer ought to be as trained as you are and as aware as you are about what's happening and what can be done, perhaps.
We find our families are the experts. They are definitely the experts. And you have to listen to what the families are telling you. Mm. So if they're telling me that their wife or their husband or partner is not sleeping at all during the night and keeping the whole family awake because they can't settle, we have to sort of go in and say, right, okay. And then we have to sort of link in with that person and say, are you having difficulties with sleep? And they'll go, no, I'm fine, because they're sleeping during the day.
But also you must have to tell partners to start to distance themselves, because if they are getting abuse from people because of their personality changes, you've got to treat it at arm's length to some extent, because you can't get that close to it, because you're not going to be able to change it.
But they love their pet. They love their person, you see. So we couldn't turn around and say that to them. We say to them, let us know what's happening. Don't let things carry on. If it's a problem, we've got to know. Mm. Because if we don't know, we can't help. But we can help. You know, we can refer them. If they're having problems with their terrible mood or their depression or outbursts, you know, the first thing you can think about, well, is it the management of the condition? Is the household too noisy? Is it too disruptive? There's those sort of things. Can we help with a bit of medication just to calm things down? And is it at certain times of the day and the night? Are they becoming overwhelmed with things at work? Are they not coping as well as they used to?
How have the government cuts to disability benefits affected people with HD?
The biggest change I've seen is the families having to go for interviews to see whether they are viable for work. It's clearly unacceptable.
So people with Huntington's disease, which is an incurable disease and which can affect emotional states, have now actually got to go before a panel like the old means-tested days and stand there, cap in hand, while somebody on high decides that, perhaps we should continue to give you the money.
There's definitely having to go for more face-to-face assessments. So you fill out this 40-page form, you explain what Huntington's disease is, how it's affecting them. These are all the consultants they're seeing. These are all the health professionals are seeing. And they're still having to go for a face-to-face assessment.
And who are these face-to-face assessors? Are they medical professionals?
Yes, they are.
Are they sort of outsourced by the government to sort of get the money back to work, no matter how much they got Huntington's disease or anything else?
The criteria for any benefit, either it would be PIP or the old DLA, it shouldn't be diagnosed-led. And I understand that. So if somebody's in the very early stages of Huntington's, they can still work. You know, they still want to work. It's when the disease starts to affect their ability to work, and then they have to give up work.
But have you had any deserving cases have their benefits stopped?
Many times.
And they restored after your intervention?
Yes, we had one particular lady. It was 5 months it took to get her benefits, and she had 3 young children. And she was going down to the food bank. And apparently after so many trips to the food bank, you're not allowed any food. But it turns out, after me writing to the House of Commons and copying it into, I think it was David Cameron, and copying it into my managers as well, it turns out actually it wasn't her fault with the form filling. It was to do with somebody in the DWP had ticked the wrong box. Mm-hmm. But she was... she was humiliated, actually, and the way she was treated was appalling. Mm-hmm. But actually, when I sent that email within a few minutes I got a phone call and it was dealt with that day. And she got 5 months worth of benefits backdated. But the branch, if they hadn't been on board, I mean, I would have gone through our charity anyway, but we managed to get her, you know.
But anybody listening to this would think it's a disgrace in this day and age.
It is a disgrace, actually. You know, but I have to say,
bankers are feathering their nests and people are scrabbling around for food with life-threatening diseases.
Well, I just
you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a personal thing, really. I think, you know, in this country, that we have food banks, we never had it 14 years ago, so I don't really know what's happened, really. But benefits will just stop for no reason. You know, that my person might have forgotten to fill in a form or they haven't responded to a letter, because cognitively they're very affected, or the short-term memory's affected. So, and then I'll get a phone call saying, I've got no money in the bank, my benefits haven't started. Then we got the issue then, if they're 60 miles away and they haven't got a social worker, I have to then scrabble around looking for a family member. If you apply for PIP now, for a personal independence payment, that's the new deal.
Yeah.
It's the new DLA, Disability Living Allowance. If you have to apply for PIP now, you have to ring through and you're on the phone 15, 20 minutes.
Well, half these people can't even hold the phone because they're shaking.
Precisely, and they can't communicate either.
But where's the sense in that? Who's running this government? Yeah.
So sometimes I'm making appointments to go out and see people because I say, we're going to apply for PIP today, and I'll sit with them and I'll explain to the person on the phone, this person's got Huntington's, that I'm there as a specialist advisor. And not a lot of the advisors will do that, because I'm quite confident with doing out PIP. I did it when I was working in the social care team. So I'm not, it doesn't faze me filling out a 40-page form, but it's a huge amount of work. And then we sit there for 20 minutes and they go, right, OK, we'll send you the form. So you have to justify the form. But I can understand why they're doing it, because they do need to clamp down. Sometimes I feel they're clamping down on the wrong people.
Who should they be clamping down on then?
The scoundrels, really. Yeah. The ones who are. You see them, you know.
They're taking a shotgun when they should be taking an air rifle with the problem.
Once the doctors understand they've got Huntington's, and I've turned up at the assessment or the face-to-face assessment, I'm saying, yeah, I've travelled 60 miles today to be with this person in Bristol, to sit here, to quantify that this person with Huntington's has this condition. And they're sat in the chair, very fidgety, very restless, very anxious. You know, it's taken them hours. We woke up the early hours of the morning to get there. And I'm, you know, and the fretting because, I'm trying to find a parking space. And then sitting with them through this assessment. And
what happens then? Does that last for 2 years and they got to go back again?
Well, they say it's not indefinite. So people who are sort of what I call end of life shouldn't justify having to go. You know, I'll say, you know, they're actually really poorly. They're getting 24-hour care.
Mm.
You know, they can't communicate.
But they're not expecting them to go to before a tribunal,
are they? No. They're going to be pretty good. So, you know, there are people that I can go to and say that's not going to happen.
Mm. But it should be built into the system that people were in that condition, they should have a folder stamp, end-of-life condition, and don't bother them anymore.
Yeah, but they don't.
You've been listening to a roving report on Huntington's disease by Terry Meekham, with special guest Carol Dutton of the Huntington's Disease Association. For more roving reports, visit www.terrymeekham.com or look online at your community radio schedules. Community Radio, daring to be different.